And to distribute. Where are your notes? I told you to make copies.
She jumped up from the chair. He watched her run back to the desk, then returned to his office with a handful of photocopies.
I did them after I pulled all of those rape cases for you.
He snatched the papers out of her hand. Jeffrey scanned her neat block writing. Her notes read like a PowerPoint presentation.
You rewrote these. This isn't what you showed me yesterday.
He found the bullet-pointed steps she had taken to assess Rebecca Catarino's body. A passage had been added, explaining in detail how she had checked both the carotid and wrist twice.
Are you willing to put your hand on a Bible in front of a judge and swear this is the truth?
Lena's throat worked.
Yes, Chief.
Jesus.
He flipped through the copies. Every detail looked so uniform that it could have come out of a typewriter. He turned the page. Preliminary interview with Leslie Truong. Man with black knit cap. No idea how old, / hair color, / eye color. Can't remember what he was wearing. Did not speak to each other. Nothing suspicious. Jeffrey felt a sharp pain in his jaw. He'd read her official report. Nothing about a man with a black knit cap was anywhere to be found.
What the fuck is this?
Lena craned her neck to see.
What she said? Leslie, I wrote down...
Leslie Truong, the woman who found Rebecca Catarino, saw a man in a knit cap, and you didn't think that was important enough to tell me?
Lena's face told him she knew exactly how much she had fucked up.
It didn't seem important, Chief.
Jesus Christ. I told you everything was important. What else did she say?
Nothing, Lena said. I mean, something, what I wrote down. That's all she said. I swear to God. I asked her if she'd seen anybody in the area, and she said about 4 different people. 3 women she didn't know, but she thought they were students, and 1 guy, and that's the guy she described. But it's not really a description, is it? I swear that's all she said. It was nothing. We all thought Catarino was an accident.
Not all of us, Lena.
He was gripping the pages hard enough to crumple them in his hand.
Leslie Truong was mutilated. Do you know what was done to her? The witness you let walk away?
Jeffrey threw Sarah's summary in her direction. She struggled to catch it. Then she read the words. He watched the horror spread across her face.
That!
Jeffrey stabbed his finger into the paper.
That's what happened to the woman who saw the attacker's face. You let her go. She had a goddamn target on her back, and you sent her into the woods on her own. And this is what happened to her.
Lena looked sick. Jeffrey was glad.
Chief,
you need to get your ass over to that construction site right now before I take your badge and frog march you out of my squad room.
She jumped out of the chair. He wasn't going to let her off that easy.
You come directly back here when you're finished, you hear me? Don't dawdle around, don't wander off chasing your tail. Right back here. I mean it.
Yes, Chief.
He watched her run past Frank through the saloon doors. Jeffrey turned toward the window. Lena was in the parking lot. She was trying to unlock the door to her Celica.
Chief?
Frank was at the door expecting an explanation.
Not now.
Jeffrey had to get out of this building before he ripped it apart with his bare hands.
I'll be back for the briefing. I'm on my phone if something comes up.
Frank stepped aside to let him pass. Jeffrey ignored the looks in the squad room, Marla's pursed lips behind the reception desk. He resisted the temptation to kick open the saloon doors. He kept his shit together until he was outside on the sidewalk.
Fucking goddamn fucking shit!
He hissed, fisting his hands inside of his pockets. A cold breeze pushed back against him as he walked the length of Main Street. Still, he was sweating by the time he took a left toward the lake. The wind turned into a knife as it sliced across the water. The grass was still wet with dew. He watched the cuffs of his gray pants slowly turn black from the moisture. Geoffrey forced his hands to unclench. He tried to rationalize away his anger. Lena had fucked up, but she worked for him, which meant that every mistake she made fell squarely on his shoulders. He tried to see her side of things. He'd told her to clean up her notes. She had cleaned up her notes. When she had talked to Leslie Truong, she had believed that Rebecca Catarino had suffered from an unfortunate accident. Could Geoffrey honestly say that he would have found an escort to take the young woman back to campus? He sure as fucking hell would have mentioned to his boss that there was a man in a black knit cap roaming around a crime scene. What kind of knit cap? What did nondescript mean? Average height, body type, hair color? Or did she mean his face was absent a beard, mustache, piercing, tattoo? Shit. Geoffrey needed to talk to Lena again, this time without yelling at her. Her original notebook was somewhere. He needed to see the details from her interview with Leslie Truong. He turned around, glancing at the back of the houses along the lake. He was about half a mile from downtown. Sarah's house was another quarter mile in the other direction. Geoffrey thought about knocking on her door. He had the pretense of the autopsy. He could pretend he hadn't seen the facts back in his office. Sarah would be getting ready for work, probably exhausted from the long night. Maybe they could take some coffee onto the back porch, and he could walk her through the case, and she could sprinkle around some of her white magic to clear his mind, and he could go back to the station and figure out how to stop a sadistic killer from attacking another student. Geoffrey rubbed his mouth. It was a nice fantasy while it lasted. He walked between two houses and found his way to her street. The wet hem of his pants stuck to the back of his calves. The sun was blinding. He held up his hand to shield his eyes. Sarah was standing 50 yards away. She was dressed in running gear, her hair tied up behind her head, her breath visible in the crisp morning air. She had her hands on her hips. She did not look happy to see him. Geoffrey lifted his hand to wave, but she turned her back on him and started to run. Without knowing what he was doing, Geoffrey found himself running after her. Call it stupidity or desperation or a cop's training. If someone was running away from you, then you chased after them. Sarah sprinted around a steep curve that followed the lakeshore. Geoffrey picked up his feet, pumped his arms. She had a head start, but he was a stronger runner. He saw her cut through Mrs. Beeman's front yard. He sidestepped into the Porter's driveway, then through their backyard. By the time they both reached the lake, he'd cut about 20 yards off her head start. Sarah wasn't good on the grass. She looked back over her shoulder. Geoffrey gained another 5 yards. He gulped a mouthful of air and pushed his legs until they were screaming. Another 5 yards gained, but Sarah had reached the back of her property. Her foot slipped as she sprinted up the steep slope toward the house, the same steep slope that her Honda had rolled down. Geoffrey narrowed the gap even more, jumping over the retaining wall, cutting across the lawn. He was close enough to smell the sweat on her as she darted up the stairs. He hurtled the steps, his foot catching on the top tread. He righted himself, but he couldn't stop his momentum. He watched the door slam, and then, wily coyote-like, Geoffrey slammed face first into the door.
Fuck!
His hands went to his nose. Blood poured between his fingers.
Fuck!
He leaned over. Blood dripped onto the deck. He saw stars. His nose had to be broken. He could feel it beating like a second heart.
Sarah?
He banged on the door.
Sarah!
Geoffrey heard an engine start. The Z4. He was familiar with the low grumble. He heard it every fucking time he was in his office and Sarah started the $80,000 sports car across the street. He shook the blood off his hands. He found his handkerchief in his back pocket. It took every bit of Jeffrey's self-control not to run around to the side of the house and watch her drive away. Atlanta, Chapter 19. Gina Vogel forced her shoulders to slide away from her ears as she pushed her shopping cart up and down the aisles of the local Target. Her period had forced her out into the world. She'd scrounged up 2 tampons in her purse and 1 in her gym bag before running out of options. Her overly familiar relationship with her Instacart delivery boy precluded home delivery. Amazon 2-day shipping was 2 days too late, and she wasn't so far gone that she was willing to spend $49.65 to overnight a box of tampons that she could get for $8 at the store. Besides, a woman couldn't just buy tampons. She needed chocolate, Advil, more chocolate, and a bag of miniature-sized candy bars because treats did not have calories if you could fit the entire serving into your mouth. Despite these inducements, Shawshanking her way out of the house had been embarrassingly difficult. Gina had procrastinated for as long as she could, making do with so much wadded-up toilet paper that her bathroom looked like Jeffrey Dahmer's kitchen. Even then, Gina had found excuses. She had vacuumed the house top to bottom, cleaned the baseboards, dusted the ceiling fans, light fixtures, and the parts of the blinds she could reach with slats closed. She'd even worked through the night to finish her report for Beijing. Honestly, Gina hadn't been this manic since she'd tried Coke those 300 times in college. Forcing herself to get dressed had been the hard part. Gina had always been of the mind that once you put on the proper attire, gym togs, business suits, edible panties, you were pretty much locked into the task appropriate to the outfit. Pulling on a pair of sweatpants had not been the hard part. Sweatpants were, in fact, an integral part of her day pajama garanimal sets. Walking out the door, exposing herself to not only the nosy neighbor across the street, but to the public at large, had felt like an unbearably risky proposition. Gina was being watched. She knew this for a fact. But she was not sure enough about this fact to tell her sister or the police. Just the thought of the 911 call made her cheeks catch fire. "Yes, could you please help me leave my house? I promise I'm not crazy, but you see, I stole this scrunchie from my mopey annoying niece. Yes, that's the one. And now someone stole it from me, and I feel eyes on me wherever I go, and yes, I'll hold. Hello? Hello? Is there anybody out there?" Gina had started to compare her paranoia to one of those weird pantyhose masks that bank robbers wore in movies. Or maybe in real life. Whatever. The point was, she felt the weight of her trepidation like an actual thing that was smooshing down her features. She had been so anxious about leaving the house that she had made 2 false starts, both times getting as far as the car, once even starting the engine, before running back inside like the stupid girl in a horror movie who you knew was going to trip and fall and get chainsawed in 2. Gina had pledged a sorority. It was totally on brand. Finally, a phone call from her sister had propelled her out into the world. Nancy was furious at her daughter. Gina relished these rare opportunities for cattiness because it was the only time her sister ever admitted that the girl was an ungodly sulk. This time, there had been a pregnancy scare, because who would have ever guessed that sometimes condoms did not work? Why wasn't there an article? Or a Discovery Investigates? Gina had gasped all the right, "Oh dears," and "How could she's?" and "Oh no, she didn't's," to pull out every juicy dramatic tidbit. But after an hour, Nancy had eventually gotten around to asking Gina what she was up to. "I was actually on my way to the Target," Gina had said, and vocalizing her intentions had been the final push that sent her not just out the door, not just behind the wheel of her car, but driving down the street like an adult person who knows how to drive down streets. Thankfully, her local Target was sparsely populated in the early morning hours. There seemed to be more clerks than shoppers. Gina groaned as the grocery cart twisted out of her grip. She had done that stupid thing where she'd pulled out a cart, then gotten 10 feet away before she'd realized that one of the wheels was wonky. But instead of simply walking 10 feet back, she had trudged on like that member of the Donner Party, who kept insisting there was a jack-in-the-box just over the next hill. Gina checked the items in the cart against her mental list. Toilet paper, paper towels, ice cream, chocolate syrup, a bag of miniature chocolate bars, big chocolate bars, 2 Twix so they didn't get lonely, and Advil with the arthritis cap, even though she was too young to need it, but also too fucking old to see how to line up the arrows without a magnifying glass. And why did they make them so hard to pop off in the first place?
Duh, she mumbled.
Tampons. Of course the feminine products were clear on the other side of the store, tucked into the back corner alongside baby diapers and incontinence panties and all those other gross vagina products that need not ever trouble a man's gaze. Housewares, bed linens, towels, sporting goods. Target didn't sell guns. Neither did Walmart or Dick's. Shockingly, it was illegal to buy a gun online and have said gun shipped to your house. The closest gun boutique, or whatever it was called, that Gina could find online was located outside the perimeter. She might very well be paranoid and possibly in the throes of a psychotic break, but she was not going to drive outside the perimeter. Besides, this was America. Where was the fucking NRA? She should be able to buy an AK-47 from a vending machine outside any subway. Feminine products. Gina bypassed the giant boxes of pads. She slowed the cart to peruse the more discreet feminine offerings. Tampax had a line called Radiant that instantly brought to mind a spotlight shining out from her cooch. Pearl made her think of oysters, which reminded her of a cartoon an ex-boyfriend had once shown her. A blind man was walking by a display outside a fish market and said, "Good morning, ladies." Ha. Ha. Ex-boyfriend. Her eyes skipped around the various products, all colored in pink or blue, just like the baby crap. Cardboard applicator, plastic applicator, no applicator. Heavy flow, medium flow, light flow. Who were those bitches? Click Compact reminded her of a gynecologist's speculum. Sport Fresh, because you love sweating on your period. Smooth, like the bottom of that baby that you are not going to have in 9 months. Security, a padlock for your pussy. Gentle Glide, worst pickup line ever. Organic, why go outside to compost? Anti-slip, rubbery grip, the hot new jam from Salt and Pepper. Gina ended up with her old standby, Playtex Sport with Flex Fit technology. The box was the usual pink and blue, but it also showed the green silhouette of a happy, slim woman jogging along the road, Gone Girl hair flipping off to the side, iPhone strapped to her arm, earphone cords dangling, because, like Gina, she couldn't be bothered to figure out how to work the cordless Bluetooth earbuds that looked like white snot dripping out of everyone's ears. Gina imagined the marketing meeting at Playtex. The men had pitched the athletic, happily green gal, and the women had pitched a dark red, almost black silhouette of a perimenopausal female curled into the fetal position, screaming on the floor of her bathroom. Tough decision. The wonky wheel nearly sent her cart into a diaper display. Gina contemplated the vandalism with a sense of satisfaction, but she was not that kind of rogue, at least not at the moment. She muscled the cart around. She snagged a 24-pack of AAA batteries en route to the cash register, because her vibrator was wildly into period sex. She was looking for her card to swipe through the reader when she realized that at least 10 minutes had passed without experiencing debilitating paranoia. Gina glanced around the checkout area. An exhausted-looking mother struggled with a baby. A manager-looking employee stifled a yawn as she looked at her clipboard. The young guy at the cash register, who'd scanned through what an FBI profiler would call a period kit, had barely looked at her face. A full week had passed since Gina had felt herself genuinely smile. Ah, life's rich tapestry. One minute you were holed up in a bunker, Googling machine gun home delivery. The next, you are out in the world, tapping your foot to the Muzak version of Funky Cold Medina. This brother told me a secret on how to get more chicks. Tone Locke had been such a visionary. He'd predicted both the downfall of Bill Cosby and the glorious rise of RuPaul.
Ma'am?
The checkout guy was waiting. Gina would not let the ma'am break her cheery mood. She swiped her Amex through the reader. She swirled her signature across the box. She was overly polite to the checkout guy, which he clearly interpreted as MILF desperation. Or MILMF, as the case may be. She shoved the tediously long receipt into her purse. She pushed the recalcitrant cart through the sliding doors. Sunshine! Who would have guessed it? Her car was parked in the rear of the lot, something she'd viewed as her own fear factor challenge when she'd first pulled into the shopping center. Now Gina was glad for the exercise. Her hamstrings had curled into question marks from liaising on the couch, Miss Pity Pat style, nearly 24 hours a day. Sure, she felt gross and sweaty and crampy from her period. But for the first time in adult Gina history, that was not actually the worst thing currently happening in her life. They should put her silhouette on one of those damn boxes. Gina, bring on the clots. She opened her trunk. Even the wonky wheel, which jerked the cart into her bumper, could not sully her mood. She tossed her bags into the car. She reached in for one of the Twix. Gina ripped open the wrapper with her teeth. She fed both crunchy, chocolatey bars into her mouth, like a piece of paper rolling into a typewriter, a simile that anyone under the age of 30 would not understand. Like an asshole, she was too lazy to walk all the way back to the store to return her cart. She had the decency to leave it on the grassy divider beside her car. She got into the driver's seat. She contemplated getting the other Twix out of her trunk, but the ice cream might melt. So she should eat the ice cream too. Should she go back into the Target and buy a spoon? Surely she could not eat such a thing with her hands. Surely she could not tip the carton and slurp from its wonders as the ancient gods took succor from helpless virgins. Gina heard a noise from the back seat. Her eyes nervously flicked to the rearview mirror. She saw a man's hand, then his arm, then his shoulder. Unusually, her gaze did not follow the natural direction toward his face. Her eyes snapped back to center, focusing on the flash of sunlight off metal. Her mouth, still full of Twix, dropped open. She felt her eyes go wide, her nostrils flare. In slow motion, she followed the path of the hammer swinging back, then forward, aimed directly at the side of her head. She had only one thought, and it was incredibly stupid. I was right. Chapter 20. Will stuck his hands in his pants pockets as he walked down the hall. The pain in his knuckle made him rethink the decision. A fresh streak of blood swiped across the back of his hand. Sarah had said that she was going to put a Band-Aid on the cut. It wasn't like her to forget, but they were both having to get used to new experiences. She was giving him space, respecting his feelings. This sounded great on paper, but in actual life, Will had never once had anyone give him space, let alone respect his feelings. He wasn't sure how to navigate his way back. When he got mad at Amanda, she bullied and humiliated him until he dropped it. Faith over-apologized, groveling, calling herself a bad person, until he gave in to shut her up and put them both out of their misery. Angie had hurt him all the time, but then she'd go away, and by the time she showed back up again, Will was over it. And sex-starved, which was another way she got him. None of these strategies was going to work with Sarah. The fact that she was unlike anyone in his life was one of her biggest draws. But this space thing was completely foreign territory. It felt like a very bad idea for Sarah to expect him to fix it. What he really wanted to do was text her an eggplant. Then she could text him a cowgirl. Then things would go back to normal. He ducked into the kitchen to wash the blood off his hand, but he found himself at the vending machine. Will hadn't eaten in over an hour. He fed a dollar bill into the slot. The spiral turned. The sticky bun dropped. Will got back a quarter, which was half of what he needed for a Sprite. He had to twist around to get the change out of his opposite pocket with his opposite hand. Will moved down to the sodas. He had a sick love of the high-tech machine. He fed in the money. He watched through the glass as the robot arm slid down the track so the robot hand could grip the can of Sprite and drop it into the bin below.
Sup, Bubba?
Nick came up beside him and did that weird shoulder grip pat.
I had some additional thoughts about that profile the Phoebes ran for the chief.
Will put his snack on the counter and washed the blood off his hand. The shoulder thing was starting to grate. Also grating? The way Nick called Tolliver the chief, like he was Crazy Horse drop-kicking Custer's ass into the Little Bighorn, instead of a small-town cop who had pissed off the wrong criminal and ended up getting himself murdered. Will dried his hands as he turned back around.
What about it?
Nick was digging in his pocket for change. His jeans were so tight that the outline of his fingers was visible.
You got any quarters?
Nope.
Will was flush with quarters, but his shoulder was hurting too badly from all the grab padding to retrieve them.
The report?
Right. I was looking at my old notebooks, and it jogged my memory about this conversation the chief and me had.
Nick extricated his hand. He picked out the coins, then dropped them into the machine as he told Will.
We were going over the profile. This was about a year after their arrest, you know? And the chief, he had a problem with how the profile was lining up against Nesbitt.
Will remembered Nick's evaluation during the briefing.
You said it hit Nesbitt in the sweetmeats.
Yeah, but reading through my notes just now, I saw where the chief wondered about that. He was suspicious because the profile was so exact. Like maybe some paper pusher Phoebe saw Nesbitt was arrested and tailored the profile to fit him.
Nick shrugged.
Those fellas want to get the bad guys as much as we do. Maybe they got a little too eager and reverse-engineered the profile so it matched what we knew about Nesbitt.
Will leaned back against the counter, watching Nick punch his selection into the machine.
Damn, Hoss, did you get the last Sprite?
Nick punched the buttons a second time. He pressed his face against the glass to check the rows. Will turned, giving the Sprite can several hard shakes before turning back around.
Take mine. I've got another one in my office.
Nick took the can.
Thanks, buddy.
So why did the chief think somebody took a shortcut?
Nick paused, clearly registering Will's tone. Still, he said,
all we really had were photos from the Truong crime scene and a couple of shots taken on a BlackBerry of Caterino. That's two crime scenes that didn't have a lot of similarities. What do you call it when that happens?
Will could see he was expecting an answer. He shook his head. Nick tapped his finger twice on the top of the Sprite can.
Statistical conclusion validity.
Will thought it had more to do with the findings not generalizing due to an underpowered study, but he said,
it's possible.
Possible? I'd bet my left nut on it,
Nick said.
I trust the chief more than I trust my memory, if you catch my drift. The guy was as sharp as they come. Damn fine cop. Best man I ever knew.
Will caught his drift.
Anyway.
Nick popped the ring on the can. Sprite gushed up like Old Faithful.
Shit!
Nick stepped back, but not quickly enough to dodge the spray. His jeans were soaked through at the crotch. Some had even sprinkled into his beard.
Shit!
Will reached over for some paper towels. Nick glared up at him, calculating. Will calculated back. There were the obvious numbers. Nick was 15 years older and 30 pounds lighter, not to mention at least a foot shorter. Then there were the variables. They worked together. The Sarah factor. They had kept up this charade for so long that breaking it would be admitting that the game was being played in the first place.
Boys.
Amanda had quietly appeared in the kitchen. Nick chucked the Sprite can into the garbage on his way out the door. Amanda raised an eyebrow at Will. Why can't I see your phone? Will had forgotten about turning off his phone. He held it up so Amanda could see. How many lines are you going to cross this morning?
Two.
He indicated the suit he'd changed into.
The first one has been rectified.
Amanda frowned, but let it go.
Catch me up on this interminable holding pattern we're all stuck in.
Will heard his inner faith pointing out that there were steps that would take them out of the holding pattern, such as talking to several different police jurisdictions about a serial killer. But he was not faith, and he had tripped over enough lines already. He said,
We're still waiting for Dirk Masterson's ISP to process the subpoena. Faith's been working through Gerald Catarino's murder closet. I put out a statewide APB for any missing women, or women who've reported that they're being stalked. Then I followed up on our other open cases.
Ah, actual police work, Amanda said.
Bullet points.
Will gave her the rundown. An arson investigation in Chattooga was about to lead to an arrest. A lie detector exam had been scheduled for a suspect in a string of Muskogee liquor store robberies. He'd sent a sketch artist to Forsyth to talk to the possible victim of a serial rapist. The Troutland County Sheriff's Office was sending a deputy with some saliva samples to process.
Good. I want you to email your reports to Caroline. I've got a busy day. She's handling my workload.
Caroline was Amanda's assistant, a patient woman who was impervious to shaming.
Yes, ma'am.
Sarah's on her way to Grant County. The coroner gave her the key to his storage facility. I told her to call me when she has the talk screen.
Will tried to act like he hadn't just been punched in the face. He did not want Sarah in Grant County right now, which was the kind of thought an overbearing, controlling boyfriend would have. Amanda looked at her watch.
I've got Caroline working on getting Shay Van Dorn's parents here. Hopefully Sarah will be back in time. I want this Dirk Masterson thing sorted ASAP. Make a call to the ISP. Tell them to put their skates on.
Do you think Masterson knows something?
I think I'm the boss and you do what I tell you to do.
Will couldn't argue with that logic. He took his sticky bun with him as he left the kitchen. He powered on his phone. It had been a dick move to hide his whereabouts from Sarah. Then again, he was the one who'd set up the Find My app on her phone. He doubted she'd ever even opened it. He tapped through to her location. She was already in Grant County, Mercer Avenue. The blue pin indicated she was inside a place called the U Store. He zoomed out the map. He toggled it into satellite mode. It looked like she was across from a rolling pasture with tombstones.
Fuck me.
No amount of eggplants and cowgirls could make this better. Will stuck the phone back in his pocket. He knocked on Faith's door as he opened it. She was sitting at her desk, injecting herself with insulin. Will started to back out, but she waved for him to sit, then pointed to her phone, which was on speaker.
Sweetheart.
Faith rolled down her shirt and disposed of the insulin pen.
I can't solve this for you. You need to talk to her in person, not on the phone, and figure it out.
Will recognized Faith's tone, which had the mixture of undying love and mild irritation that she only used with her children.
Come on, Mom!
Jeremy begged.
You told me that I can always come to you for help. This is me coming to you for your help.
Faith laughed.
Good try, sport. But if you think I'm going to jeopardize the relationship that saves me $24,000 a year in child care, then you don't know your mother.
His groan sounded identical to Faith's.
I'll bring my laundry this weekend. Bring detergent because you're doing it yourself.
Faith tapped her phone. She told Will, Jeremy is pissed off at my mother. I'm trying to let this be a teaching moment. Will saw an opportunity.
Maybe your mom should give him some space? You know, to work through how he feels?
Faith stared at him.
Blink once if the kidnappers can hear us.
Will cleared his throat. He was in this now.
It's just so he's hurt, right? But he probably needs time to let it go, so she should back off. And then he can tell her it's okay, like in a few hours? Or days, maybe. Would it be days?
Days seems like a long time.
So, hours?
He asked.
How many hours?
12?
She saw his face.
No, 3.
Will peeled the plastic wrap off his sticky bun and took in a mouthful.
I'm sorry.
Faith sounded genuinely disappointed with herself.
My son is fighting with my mother. I promised my daughter I would introduce her to Detective Pikachu if she let me pee in privacy. I did the mother load cheat because that's the only way I can give my Sims the life they deserve. Am I really the best person to ask about being an emotionally healthy adult?
Will studied the sticky bun. The white frosting was melting. He took another large bite. Faith said,
I'm useless. A suck. I'm a terrible human being.
It's okay.
Will was desperate to erase the last 5 minutes of this conversation. He tried.
There's 1,000 reasons we should go about our day.
You asshole, don't you dare try to put a song from Frozen in my head.
She jerked her chair back to her computer, obviously getting the message.
Did you see Nick? He was looking for you.
Nick was probably rinsing his balls in the bathroom sink.
He said his notes jogged his memory. Tolliver wasn't satisfied with the profile.
You mean the chief?
He loved her for saying that.
Tolliver thought it was the tail wagging the dog.
Faith drummed her fingers on the desk.
We all know the FBI isn't infallible. Look at that scandal over ballistics testing. Or the scandal over microscopic hair analysis. Or the scandal over scandals.
Will finished the sticky bun.
What about the photocopies of Lena's notes?
Faith laughed.
They read like Dickens. I mean actual Dickens. Like someone edited and copy-edited and printed them up for public consumption. Even her handwriting looks like a typewriter.
Will couldn't be disappointed because he wasn't surprised. Faith asked, why did Tolliver keep her around? She wasn't expecting a response, but he had one.
There's something to be said for giving somebody a second chance. There's also something to be said for not wanting to admit you made a mistake.
You think he was blinded by his own stubbornness?
That's Sarah's theory, that he couldn't admit that he was wrong about her. My theory is that Lena was his gray rabbit.
Will had seen the dynamic playing out in multiple police stations over the years.
The chief needs some dirty work done. He sends his gray rabbit hopping into the gray areas so that he can keep his hands lily wide. He can't fire her because she knows all of his secrets. He can't let her go because he might need her again. Usually, neither one of them sees it as a hostile transactional relationship, but they both get something out of it. Friends in foxholes, maybe.
Faith was silent for as long as you would expect to be silent if you were smearing a dead cop who happened to be the dead husband of one of your best friends.
That makes a hell of a lot of sense. She's been playing the same role on the Macon Force, too.
He licked the sugar off his fingers.
Okay, this is nothing to do with Lena.
Faith clasped her hands on the desk, facing him. I actually do have relationship advice, and it's the same thing I told Jeremy and probably the last thing you want to hear. Talk to Sarah. In person. Tell her how you feel. Tell her how to fix it. She loves you. You love her. Work it out. Will rubbed his jaw. His fingers were sticky. He nodded toward Faith's computer. Images from Gerald Catarino's murder closet were paused on the screen.
Anything?
Sadness. Faith rolled back to her monitor. I know how crime affects families. I see it every day, and it's soul-killing and awful. But I look at everything Gerald has done. The freedom of information requests, and the lawyers, and the lawsuits, and the PIs, and the notes, and phone calls, and all the money he spent, and I just... She shook her head, because there was nothing more to say. He told her,
Amanda's pushing on Masterson. I don't know why, but she smells something rotten, and she's usually right.
Sure to drive into Austin and sitting on their laps. I'm not sure I can do anything to make the ISP move faster. She slid a printout across her desk. Look at this invoice from Detective Dirk. Past due. And that's the most recent one. Catarino is into this asshole for almost 30 grand. Will saw the numbers at the top of the page.
This has a street address. I thought you said all of the checks were mailed to a post office box.
She slid over another piece of paper with a map, web address, and phone number. Mail center station. It's at one of those shipping stores where you can rent a post office box and get a street address. Will was familiar with the service. His ex-wife had been a prolific user of shadow addresses. He had been forced on a few occasions to track her down through less than legal means. He asked,
What sounds more threatening to an average person on the street? Telling them you've got a warrant or telling them you've got a subpoena?
She considered the question. I don't know. Half the federal government has ignored subpoenas. I guess a warrant? Will punched the speakerphone button on Faith's landline, knowing it showed up as the Georgia Bureau of Investigation on any caller ID. She asked, Are you getting sugar on my phone?
Yes.
He dialed the number. The phone rang once.
Mailbox center station? A chirpy young man said. This is Brian. How can I help you? Brian?
Will made his voice higher and added a thick South Georgia drawl.
This is Special Agent Nick Shelton with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. I'm filling out an official warrant for a perpetrator who rents post office box 3421 at your location. The judge is requesting the name of the box holder before he'll approve the warrant to send out the fugitive apprehension team.
Faith shook her head at the subterfuge, because anyone with a passing understanding of how the law worked would laugh in his face. Brian did not laugh. Faith's eyes bulged as they heard him typing on a keyboard. He said,
Yes, sir. I mean, special agent. I've got it. Okay, so 3421 is rented to Miranda Newbury. Do you need her address?
Faith knocked over her pencil cup, scrambling for something to write with. Will said,
Go ahead, son. It's 4825 Dutch Drive, Marietta, 30062. Thanks, fella.
Will hung up the phone. Holy shit. Faye threw up her arms like a ref calling a field goal.
That was amazing.
Miranda Newbury.
Faye swung around to her computer. She started typing, then frowning, then growling.
Oh, for the love of...
Will waited as she furiously clicked the mouse. Finally, Faith said,
Miranda Newbury is an unmarried 29-year-old CPA who graduated from Georgia State and spends most of her time on crime blogs and, are you kidding me? She's on six different YA message boards. That's exactly what I need. a white suburban millennial, dictating what books are culturally appropriate for my brown daughter.
Fraud?
Will said, because it wasn't necessarily a crime to impersonate someone online, but it was definitely illegal to do it for money.
Impersonating a police officer?
Oh, shit, look. Faith pointed to the screen. She just insted a photo of the big chicken. She says she's meeting her boyfriend for lunch in an hour.
Will stood up.
I'll drive.
The big chicken was located at the intersection of Cobb Parkway and Roswell Road. The name came from the nearly 60-foot-tall sign that was shaped like a giant chicken, sticking up its head from an otherwise unremarkable Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurant. Locals used it as a landmark. Directions were given based on whether they were before or after, to the left or to the right, of the big chicken. Will glanced over his shoulder as the door opened. The KFC was packed with lunchgoers from local businesses. He saw Faith holding down their spot at a booth in the back. She was looking down at her phone. They had gotten here 15 minutes ahead of Miranda Newberry, who was running 15 minutes late. The door opened. He glanced over his shoulder again. Still no Miranda Newberry. Will finished filling up his cup with Dr. Pepper at the soda machine. He walked back toward Faith, scanning the other booths. Miranda Newberry's Facebook banner had showed a very thin woman holding two Pomeranians she had dressed like Bonnie and Clyde. Will had silently endured Faith's small dog jokes. Betty, his dog, was a Chihuahua. Sometimes people got stuck with small dogs and all they could do was take care of them.
Nothing.
Faith was still bent over her phone as he sat down across from her.
She's clearly a liar. She could have been lying about meeting her boyfriend. I bet he lives in Canada.
Will said nothing. He had fond memories of his own Canadian girlfriend from high school. She had been a supermodel. He asked,
"Do you want something else to eat?"
Faith scrunched up her face. Her salad had looked like someone had already eaten it. She asked,
"Why am I so annoyed about her young adult book reviews?"
Will drank his Dr. Pepper.
"Okay. I admit I look like the textbook white lady who screams at the guy working the omelet station because cheese costs 50 cents extra."
She took a breath.
"But the only reason, and I mean the only reason I never tried Coke, was because of what happened to Regina Morrow. And don't even get me started on Go Ask Alice. That book scared the ever-loving shit out of me. I had no idea what the hell angel dust was, and I was still terrified. Does it matter if some 200-year-old ghostwriter thought Digit Man was how young people talked?"
The door opened. Faith tensed.
Will shook his head.
Faith ripped a handful of napkins from the dispenser and cleaned off her phone.
"Did I tell you the other day I wiped some guacamole off my iPad and accidentally liked a post by this moron I went to high school with?"
"Heads up."
The door had opened again. Miranda Newberry looked almost exactly like her photos. Her bangs were shorter. She was wearing a bright orange dress with blue and green flowers. Her purse was as big as a feed bag, with dangly tassels and beadwork. Will cataloged the various types of weapons that could be concealed inside, from a switchblade to a .357 Magnum. Judging her based solely on her social media, he assumed it was more likely she had some outfits for her dogs and several stolen credit cards. Faith turned her camera on selfie mode so she could watch the action behind her. Miranda did not look around the restaurant like a person who was looking for a boyfriend she was supposed to have lunch with. She stood off to the side of the packed front counter, held up her phone, smiled, took a selfie, then headed back out the door. Faith jumped out of the booth ahead of Will. They jogged across the dining room. Outside, Miranda did not get into a white Honda CRX that was registered in her name. She stayed on foot, crossing the narrow street that curved behind the big chicken. Then she kept going through a row of shrubs. Will caught up with Faith in the parking lot of a truck dealership.
I hope we don't lose sight of her.
She was joking. The bright orange dress was like a parking cone. Where is she going? Faith edged between two white vans. Will smelled French fries.
Wendy's.
He was right. Miranda headed directly toward the low-slung building and yanked open the door. Will and Faith slowed their roll. Through the plate glass, he could see Miranda standing in line to order. The Wendy's was only half full. There were plenty of spaces in the parking lot. He'd just eaten a 3-piece big box meal, but the smell of fries made him hungry again. They split off inside the restaurant, taking opposite roles. Will found a booth in the dining room. Faith stood behind Miranda in the line. From his perch, Will could see Faith peering over the woman's shoulder, reading her phone. Like most people, Miranda was wholly consumed by the screen. She had no idea that a cop was standing behind her, though Faith's gun was on her hip under her suit jacket. Will watched two more patrons enter the restaurant. He tried to put himself in Miranda's position. What kind of person posted a photo of a restaurant that she was not going to eat at and mentioned a boyfriend that she did not have? He guessed the sort of person who catfished a desperate father and built him out of 30 grand. Faith caught his attention as Miranda waited for her order to be filled. Faith looked pissed, but that was nothing new. The cashier called her up. Faith kept her body turned sideways, placing an order while she kept Miranda in her sightline. The woman remained oblivious. She was clearly enthralled by whatever was on her phone. Will could see a tiny bump in the back of her neck, where the vertebrae had conformed to her head, constantly being bent toward a screen. Miranda finally glanced up. Her order was ready. She took the tray that was waiting for her on the counter. Single, fries, drink. She filled her cup with unsweetened tea. Faith was directly beside her, filling her cup with soda, while Miranda moved on to the condiments. Straw, napkins, salt, plastic silverware. She pumped the ketchup dispenser, filling 6 tiny paper cups. Miranda headed toward the side of the dining area where a slim countertop and tall bar stools afforded a view of the muffler shop across the street.
Ma'am.
Faith flashed her ID. Miranda nearly dropped her tray.
Over there.
Faith pointed toward Will. She was in her cop stance, which instantly drew everyone's attention.
Move.
Will watched Miranda's eyes slide around the dining room. She looked guilty just standing there. Will hadn't chosen the booth at random. Between his position and Faith's, they had effectively covered all exit points. Tea splashed out of Miranda's cup. Her hands were shaking. She took some very small steps toward the booth. Then some large ones, when Faith turned her cop attitude to loud. Faith was a petite woman, but she could be menacing when the situation called for it. Miranda slid into the booth across from Will. Faith got in beside her and pushed Miranda farther along the bench until she was effectively trapped against the wall. Will made the introductions, because Faith had taken his usual position of being the silent, unpredictable one.
I'm Trent. This is Mitchell.
Miranda studied his ID. Her hands were still trembling.
Is this real?
Faith slapped her business card on the table.
Call the number.
Miranda picked up the card. She stared at it. Her eyes were wet with tears. He could see her jaw working as she gritted her teeth back and forth. The card went back down on the table. She took a French fry, dipped it into each of the 6 ketchups, then shoved it into her mouth. Will looked at Faith while Miranda silently chewed. He guessed the woman had decided to pretend like they weren't there until they gave up and left her alone. Will said,
We're here to talk to you about Gerald Catarino.
The chewing paused for a second, but she 6 dipped another fry and stuck it into her mouth. Faith reached over and Jenga-like pulled one of the fries from the pile. Miranda gave a forced sigh.
I know my rights. I don't have to talk to the police if I don't want to.
Will channeled his inner faith.
Did you learn that at the police academy, Detective Masterson?
Miranda stopped chewing.
It's not illegal to adopt an online pseudonym.
Debatable,
Will said, putting his own spin on Faith's irritated tone.
But it's illegal to impersonate a police officer, even a retired one who never existed.
The news clearly startled her. Faith put her arms along the back of the booth. Her jacket hung open. Her gun was visible to anyone who looked down. Miranda looked down. She swallowed so hard that the sound carried.
My dog got sick,
Miranda said.
She needed surgery, and then my car broke down.
Will asked,
all of that cost $30,000.
I worked for free for a whole year before I asked for anything. And then I had to keep charging because...
She realized that her voice was too loud.
I had to keep charging because it would look suspicious if I didn't.
Smart,
Faith said. Miranda's eyes cut in her direction, but she told Will.
The Masterson persona gives me validity. No one would listen to me if they knew I was a woman. You have no idea how hard.
Faith pretended to snore. Miranda said,
I'll pay you fine. I'll return the money. It's no big deal.
You're a CPA, right?
Will waited for her to nod.
Did you pay taxes on that income?
Her eyes went shifty again.
Yes,
Will said.
I need a copy of your private investigator's license, your love-to-see-murder business license, and your federal ID number or social security number so I can verify.
The money was paid out over 2 years. That qualifies for a gift tax exemption.
Faith blew out a stream of air between her lips. Will used one of Faith's favorite lines.
Can we cut the bullshit?
Miranda's jaw tightened.
I don't have to talk to you.
We can arrest you on the catfishing alone.
She pushed away the tray.
Look, okay. I accepted Gerald's gift money, but I was really helping him. Do you think that dinosaur knows how to do a deep dive on the internet?
Faith couldn't stay silent. Is 30K the going rate for setting up a Google alert and cutting out some articles?
I did a heck of a lot more than that. Hours more. I crunched the data. I showed him patterns.
She reached into her purse. Faith clamped her hand around the woman's wrist.
Ow!
Miranda winced.
I was just getting my phone. It's in my bag.
Faith took the plastic fork off Miranda's tray and poked around the feed sack. Finally, she nodded.
Jeesh!
Miranda retrieved her phone. Her thumb started sliding across the screen.
You're right. I sent Gerald the Google alerts that highlighted articles that reported similar attacks to the one Becky suffered. Have you seen the pictures of her? She nearly died. A lot of women are dead. I'm not just investigating a string of murders. I'm hunting a freaking serial killer.
Will wasn't going to indulge her.
What patterns did you show Gerald?
Miranda worked her phone as she talked.
The cases I sent him, all of the women were abducted in either the last week of March or the last week of October. All of them disappeared in the early morning hours between 5 and noon.
He saw Faith stiffen, because the time of the women's disappearances was a detail she hadn't been privy to. Will said,
We already know about the dates and times. What else?
Did Gerald tell you about the hair stuff and the stocking?
Yes.
Which cases did he show you?
Will hedged.
Which cases do you think he showed us?
I need to start from the beginning.
Miranda turned the phone sideways and angled it so that both Will and Faith could see the screen.
Okay, so here's the original Excel spreadsheet showing all the raw data I sent to Gerald. My search criteria was women missing in Georgia over the last 8 years. It took days, sometimes weeks and months, even a year, to track down what happened after they were reported missing. We are talking thousands of hours of my time to gather this into a searchable database.
Will said,
keep going.
This cell tells you what happened to them.
She flicked her finger across the screen to a new column.
The majority of the women showed back up, which is common. Women just need a break sometimes. The rest of them ended up getting arrested for drugs or whatever. A few of them were in women's shelters because their husbands were abusive. Some never came back. But maybe they left the state or ran off with a boyfriend. But a small number of them turned up dead. Look at this column.
Faith read,
Joan Feeney, Pia Dansky, Shay Van Dorn, Alexandra McAllister.
The same names that Faith had weeded out from Gerald's list. Will said,
according to Gerald Catarino, there were more victims than what you have in the columns.
He was wrong. I swear he was just seeing what he wanted to see. I bet he never showed you my total list here.
She swiped the screen again.
This cell has the October abductions over the last 8 years. This has the March ones. Gerald dismissed a lot of the names I gave him because he either couldn't get in touch with the family, or they didn't report hearing about a missing hair item, or the victims never reported that they felt like they were being stalked. But I thought a few of the women belonged on the list because they fit the other criteria.
Will saw an imperceptible shift in Faith's features. She was reading ahead. She knew Miranda was onto something. Will asked,
what about the other criteria?
Like I said, they all disappeared in the morning sometime in the last week of March or the last week of October. Except for Catarina and Truong, they were going about a fairly predictable routine. On a run, heading to work, hitting the supermarket or drugstore, when they were abducted. Then, however long later, they were all found in the woods, off the official path, with their bodies mutilated in what the coroners chalked up to animal activity.
Chalked up?
Will asked.
We'll never know, because no autopsies were ever performed,
Miranda said.
This serial killer is clever, and he knows the system. He's spreading the victims across jurisdictions the same way Bundy did. He's torturing them like Dennis Rader. He's extremely methodical, the same as Kemper. He's smart enough to leave them out where animals will get to them. I don't know, maybe he's got some kind of twisted idea of Wiccan or Druid religion. This smacks of animal sacrifice, but where the animals get to eat the humans.
Will thought she'd gone off the rails, but he wasn't going to correct her.
Give me that.
Faith grabbed Miranda's phone away. She started typing.
I'm emailing the spreadsheet to myself.
Good,
Miranda said,
because I need help. I can't get the information I need to make the final connection.
What information?
Miranda held out her hand for the phone. Faith made sure the email had gone through before she turned it over. Miranda tapped to a different tab on the spreadsheet.
Becky was the first victim 8 years ago in March. But she lived, so he took another victim, Leslie Truong, and murdered her. Then, in November of that year, another victim showed up in the woods surrounding Lake Lanier in Forsyth County.
Will recognize the details.
Pia Dansky.
Right. Dansky was reported missing the morning of October 24th. She was found dead 2 weeks later. Her body showed signs of animal mutilation.
Will knew all of this was already public record.
What else?
Okay, so Becky was his first victim? We can all agree that the killer started 8 years ago, right?
Will nodded, because she didn't know about Tommy Humphrey. And if it was up to him, she never would. Miranda continued.
Since then, we have two victims a year. Multiply that times 8.5 years. Add in Becky and Leslie, and that equals 19 victims total. But if you add up the names on the list, we only have 16.
Faith had accessed the spreadsheet on her own phone. She visibly worked to cover her shock as she asked,
what's this column with three names? Alice Scott, reported missing October of last year. Teresa Singer, March, 4 years ago. Callie Zanger, March, 2 years ago. Who are they? Singer had PTSD and something called dissociative amnesia. She can't remember her own name most days. Scott suffered a TBI. Her parents are taking care of her on their horse farm. Zanger lives and works in downtown Atlanta, but she won't return my calls. I DM'd her on Facebook, sent emails. I even mailed her an actual snail mail letter. She sent me a cease and desist. She's got a lot of money or something. Back up, Faith said. What are you saying? Those are the three missing victims from the last 8 years, Miranda said. Singer, Scott, Zanger. They're the women who got away.
Grant County, Thursday. Chapter 21. The tiny broken bones in Jeffrey's nose clanged like cymbals with every word he spoke. He didn't have the option of silence. He was at the tail end of the morning patrol briefing, and already he could feel the bruises welling up under his eyes. In normal circumstances, he could walk across the street and have a doctor set the brake, but he didn't want to admit that one of those doctors had broken his nose by slamming the door in his face. If the eight patrolmen who were watching Jeffrey thought it was strange that their boss had toilet paper shoved up his nostrils, no one had the balls to comment. Jeffrey had given them the highlights of the Caterino attack and the Truong murder, holding back the more troubling details. He believed in showing his work as much as possible. These men all lived in town. They'd grown up here. They felt the same responsibility toward the community as Jeffrey. More importantly, he was about to give them a shitty assignment, and he needed them as on side as was humanly possible. He pointed to the numbers on the whiteboard, saying,
"There are 11,680 vans registered in the Tri-County area. The Grant County share is 3,498. Of those, 1,699 are dark in color. I want each of you to take a list from the stack on your way out. Do your normal patrols. But any time you catch a breather, I want you knocking on doors, eyeballing the owners, running down their details. If the name Daryl comes up in any way, shape, or form, call me, Frank, or Matt immediately. If anyone looks even remotely suspicious, then call me, Frank, or Matt immediately. Don't push them. Take a step back. Make the call. Keep yourself safe. Understood?"
Eight voices called.
"Yes, Chief."
Jeffrey stacked together his notes. Looking down sent a small explosion into his nose. He sniffed back blood. Stars filled his vision. Frank came into the room as the patrolman left. He told Jeffrey,
"I talked to Chuck Gaines. He's gonna put out an alert on the student message board to see if we can locate the three women and the man in the black knit cap that Leslie Truong saw in the woods."
"Good."
Jeffrey wasn't holding out any hope. They had already put out an alert for witnesses the day that Caterino had been attacked. 22 students had come forward, but none of them had seen anything. At least half of them probably weren't even in the woods at the right time. Jeffrey said,
"Fucking Lena."
Frank put his foot on one of the chairs. He rested his elbow on his knee. Jeffrey gathered he wasn't airing out his undercarriage.
"Say it."
"Lena's a good cop. She could be the best cop on the force one day."
"Not from where I'm sitting."
"Then stand up so you can see better. The kid made the same mistake I would have made."
Frank's shoulder went up in a shrug.
"I was there too, Chief. I saw Becky Caterino. I figured she was dead."
"Based on what, Lena?"
"Based on, she looked dead. And I'm being honest here. I'm in her shoes. I got a dead student on my hands. I got the gal who found her. And the gal says she wants to walk back. I'm gonna let that gal walk back to campus if she wants to, because why wouldn't I?
Jeffrey shook his head, because the more he asked himself the question, the more certain he was that he never would have let Truong go off on her own. Even assuming Caterino had been the victim of an accident, Truong was a kid. She'd just found a dead body. You took care of people like that. Frank was silent, except for the whistle of air through his congested lungs.
Look, there's a reason I didn't want your job. It sucks.
You think?
You're a good chief. I can't vouch for the other parts of your life. If you were fucking my daughter, a broken nose would be the least of your worries.
Frank smiled without smiling.
When you were in Birmingham, how many murders did you roll up on?
Jeffrey shook his head. Birmingham was 10 times the size of Grant County. There were over 100 homicides a year.
Probably dozens, right? And even without the DOAs, you saw blood every week, maybe every day. Stabbings, shootings, all kinds of shit. Well, here in Grant County, we get some ODs, some vehicle fatalities, a few tractor accidents, maybe a couple of knocked-down women.
Frank shrugged again.
You're bringing Birmingham thinking to Grant County situations.
Jeffrey had never seen anything like what had happened to Tommy Humphrey and Leslie Truong in Birmingham.
That's what I was hired to do.
Then do it. Lena's got potential. She's got the instincts to do the job the way it has to be done. You can either be the chief who molds her into a good cop, or you can be the asshole who shreds her into nothing because it makes you feel better.
I never took you for a psychiatrist.
Frank gave Jeffrey's shoulder that squeeze you give a man when you're bringing him to heel like a dog.
I never took you for a cheat, but here we are.
Thanks for the pep talk, Frank.
Anytime, chief.
Frank graced him with another demeaning shoulder pat before taking his leave. Out of habit, Jeffrey flipped the whiteboard toward the wall before following him out. He gathered his notes off the podium. He was rewarded with another pulsing throb in his face. He gently traced the line of his nose. There was definitely something sticking out that should not be sticking out. He held his breath, upping the pressure, trying to click the bones back into place. His eyes watered. The pain was too intense. Unless he wanted to look like a 1930s gangster for the rest of his life, he was going to end up having to go to a doctor 3 towns over who would actually see him.
Chief?
Marla walked in with a bag of frozen French fries in one hand and a bottle of Advil in the other.
I got the fries from Pete at the diner. He wants them back.
Jeffrey pressed the bag to his nose. He nodded for Marla to open the bottle.
Is Lena back yet?
Saw her car pull in when I was tootling back from the diner.
Thanks.
Jeffrey dry swallowed 4 Advil as he walked back into the squad room. Lena was taking off her bulky coat. She did her usual deer in the headlights when she saw him. He didn't like the fear he saw in her eyes. 90% of being a cop was dealing with angry men. If she couldn't handle it from her boss, she wasn't going to make it on the street. He told her,
"In my office."
Lena followed him inside. She closed the door without being told. She started to sit down, but he stopped her.
"On your feet."
Jeffrey tossed the frozen bag of fries on his desk as he took a seat. The change in altitude made his nose throb harder.
Chief.
He jabbed his finger into the photocopies of her notes.
What is this bullshit?
Lena sucked in a breath. She clearly hoped that her earlier ass-chewing was over.
Look at them.
He handed her the copies.
You're a cop. You want to be a detective one day? Tell me what's wrong with your notes, future detective.
She stared at the neatly printed words, the carefully outlined steps of her various actions.
Lena cleared her throat. There's no mistakes.
Right, Jeffrey said. No run-on sentences, no stray marks, no cross-throughs, not even a misspelled word. You're either the smartest fucking cop in this building or you're the stupidest. Which one is it?
Lena placed the copies back on his desk. She shifted on her feet.
Which notes do you want me to keep, Lena? Which set do you want subpoenaed by Gerald Catarino's lawyers? Or Benito Truong's? Because her daughter was murdered when you told her to go back to the school on her own.
Lena kept her gaze down.
You're going to be sworn in under oath. Which set of notes is the truth?
Lena did not look up, but she put her hand on the copies. These? He sat back in his chair. The frozen bag of fries was leaving a wet mark on his desk.
Where's your original notebook?
At home.
Get rid of it,
he told her.
If this is your choice, then you need to stand by it.
Yes, sir.
Tell me about your interview with Leslie Truong.
Lena shifted nervously on her feet.
I asked her if she had seen anyone else in the area. She said she passed three women on her walk into the woods. They were heading toward the college. Two of them were wearing Grant Tech colors. The other wasn't, but she looked like a student. Leslie didn't recognize any of them. I really pressed her on it, and...
And the man?
She thought maybe he was a student, too.
Lena briefly met his gaze, before quickly looking away.
All she remembered was his knit cap. It was black knit, a beanie type. She couldn't remember his features, or his hair color, or eyes, or how tall he was, or how big. She said he just looked like a regular guy. Probably a student. He was jogging down the path.
Jogging, not running.
That's what I asked, and she said definitely jogging. He wasn't acting suspicious or anything. She assumed he was a student out for a run.
She said student, meaning he was in that age group.
I asked, and she said she couldn't say, except that he ran like he was younger. I guess older people, when they run, maybe they've got bad knees or they aren't as fast.
She shrugged.
I'm sorry, Chief. Is she dead because that?
Her eyes met his. This time she did not look away. Frank's words came back to Jeffrey. He could crush her right now. He could say the thing that would grind her into dust and she would never be able to do the job again. He said,
"She's dead because someone murdered her."
The overhead light caught the moisture in her eyes.
The vast majority of policing is social work.
He had told her this before, but he hoped like hell this time the lesson had meaning.
I know what it's like being on patrol. You're writing tickets all day, looking for jaywalkers, bored out of your mind. Then, a dead body shows up and it's exciting.
Lena's guilty expression confirmed he had hit on the truth.
Excitement is great, but it gives you tunnel vision. You miss things. You make stupid mistakes. We don't get a lot of leeway as police officers. We have to see everything. Even the smallest detail can mean the difference between life and death.
I'm sorry, Chief, she promised. It won't happen again.
Jeffrey wasn't finished.
The reason I moved here from Birmingham is because I was sick of locking up one drug dealer for shooting another drug dealer. I wanted to feel connected to the people I was protecting. You can be a good cop, Lena, a damn good cop, but you need to work on that connection.
Yes, Chief, I will.
Jeffrey wasn't sure she would do a damn thing, but lecturing her for another 10 minutes or 10 hours was not going to change that.
Sit down.
Lena sat on the edge of the chair. Jeffrey's nose had started to itch, like he needed to sneeze. He put the frozen fries back to his face.
Tell me about the construction site.
Lena sucked in a quick breath as she took her notebook out of her back pocket.
I talked to everyone on the site. They're building a climate-controlled storage facility.
Jeffrey nodded for her to continue.
There's, like, extra workmen from what you'd expect. Garage door installers and welders and security, alongside the usual contractors and stuff. I was gonna type this up, but...
She offered him the notebook. Jeffrey didn't take it.
You're the one who was there. Did any of the names stand out?
No, not really.
She glanced up, then back down. The guilt was back.
I was gonna run all of the names through the database to check for records or outstanding warrants, but...
He knew he wasn't going to like what was coming, but said,
Out with it.
I know you told me to go to the site and get back here as soon as possible, but...
Lena looked up at him.
I drove to the Home Depot in Memminger.
Jeffrey sat with the information. She had disobeyed his orders, again, but her instincts were good. Every contractor in the Tri-County area relied on the undocumented workers who loitered around the Home Depot. Generally, the contractors picked them up in the early morning hours, worked them to the bone for slave wages, dropped them back off at the Home Depot that night, then went to church on Sunday and complained about how immigrants were ruining the country. He asked,
Anne?
I don't speak Spanish, but I figured they would talk to me.
Lena waited for him to motion for her to continue.
At first, they were scared because of my uniform.